What's going on, guys? Welcome back to the show. Today, we're going to talk about Alzheimer's. And I just want to say off the bat, when I say Alzheimer's, I mean Alzheimer's dementia. I mean other forms of dementia. I'm using that as a term for, let's say, all neurodegenerative diseases. Although there is quite a bit of nuance between those diagnoses on an individual level, that's not what today's podcast is going to be about. And so when I say Alzheimer's, I mean Alzheimer's dementia. I mean other forms of dementia. I mean, you know, vascular dementia. And potentially other neurodegenerative diseases as well. But again, that's not necessarily what today's podcast is about. So this podcast was born out of some genetic testing I did back in 2022. And funny enough, in the making, you know, of the notes for this podcast, I wanted to go back and actually just look at the whole, you know, genome sequencing and all the things that it was a company called DNA Fit, and they were trying to spin it in some sort of fitness. They were trying to tell you, you know, they gave you things like muscle fiber type and genetic predisposition for endurance exercise or power sports or, you know, whatever, muscle growth or whatever. Company doesn't exist anymore. And I emailed them a bunch to get access to my information, and I could not. But the single thing I remember being even remotely interesting is what we're talking about today. And that is that I am at a much higher risk for Alzheimer's and a higher risk for heart disease. And you'll see in a bit why I have not forgotten that point. And this kind of tracks. Alzheimer's disease runs in my family. Grandparents, great-grandparents, my dad right now is battling, I say battling, but battling some high cholesterol, and we'll talk about how that's relevant to this sort of, to this gene. And what I'll get into in this podcast is what I learned doing genetic testing. We'll talk about should you do it. We'll go through 14 modifiable risk factors for Alzheimer's dementia that allegedly can reduce cases by up to 50%, which is super duper cool. And then we'll talk about what I've personally changed to reduce my risk, and then we'll do a recap. So back in 2022, I did some genetic testing. And again, overall, it was pretty boring. I think I was like, they were trying to assess your, like, again, your predisposition to be, you know, a good power athlete or endurance athlete or whatever. And I think I was just like kind of right down the middle on all this stuff. It just wasn't like, oh my God, you should do endurance sports, or oh my God, you should do power sports, or it just was right down the middle, pretty boring altogether. However, the biggest takeaway is that I am what's called a homozygous APOE4, or I have the, you know, two copies of the APOE4 allele. And again, I'm gonna explain what that is in a second. Essentially, all chronic diseases, all diseases have a genetic component that can increase and decrease risk, you know, all chronic diseases. For Alzheimer's, the APOE gene is of great importance. The APOE gene provides instructions for making what's called apolipoprotein E, which is a protein that helps carry cholesterol and other types of fat around the bloodstream. If there are problems in this process, right, this instruction process, the production of APOE, the way APOE acts within the body, that's not good. And it contributes to, or it can contribute to the development of Alzheimer's, and it absolutely can contribute to an increased risk of developing Alzheimer's is how I would phrase it. If you're interested in the pathophysiology of APOE and, you know, how it's specifically working within the body, I will link a show in the show notes, or a podcast in the show notes, with Simon Hill and two wonderful experts that I think is well worth a listen. And I will say, if you are a homozygous APOE4, which we'll talk about what that is, I would highly recommend going to listen to that episode. I mean, if you're just generally interested in this discussion today, you want to learn a little bit more about the pathophysiology, exactly how this is affecting your health, that is a wonderful episode. But if you are like me, carrying two copies of this APOE4 allele, I would absolutely go listen to that episode. And I think today's episode will obviously be a wonderful, you know, foundation for you to understand your risk and what to do about it. So the TLDR, APOE is an important gene in terms of Alzheimer's dementia and cardiovascular disease. Now, everybody inherits two copies of this gene. You get one from mom and one from dad. I promise I'm going to go through this thoroughly. You get two copies of the gene, one from mom and one from dad. There are three variants of the APOE gene. There's APOE2, APOE3, and APOE4. So you can get one of those, 2, 3, or 4 from mom, and one of those, 2, 3, or 4 from dad. And that makes 6 possible combinations. You can get a 2 and a 2. You can get a 2 and a 3. You can get a 2 and a 4. You can get a 3 and a 3. You can get a 3 and a 4, or you can get a 4 and a 4. Now, APOE3, or homozygous just means you have two copies of the same gene. So homo meaning, let's say, the same. And so 3, 3 would be homozygous ApoE3 or ApoE3 homozygous. Now, 3-3, so getting an ApoE3 from mom and a 3 from dad, is the most common variant in the general population. Two-thirds of the population, roughly, are E3-E3, and E3-E3 is thought to have no effect on risk. It doesn't mean you're at greater risk. It doesn't mean you are protected in some way. Let's assume that ApoE3-3 is the baseline. ApoE2 is thought to be protective, and about 10 to 15% of the population have at least one copy of E2. If you have two copies of E2, meaning you got an ApoE2 from mom and an ApoE2 from dad, that's probably the best in terms of protection against Alzheimer's and cardiovascular disease. There is one downside of the E2. It's that you have an increased risk, I think, of macular degeneration. And so that is absolutely something that if you find out you are E2, or even if you just have one copy of the E2, that I would consider, that I would talk to my doctor about, let's say. Now, ApoE4 is the bad one. About 20% of the population have one copy. 2 to 3% carry two copies. If you have one copy, you are at an increased risk of Alzheimer's by about 2 to 3 times. If you have two copies, you're about 8 to 12 times more likely to develop Alzheimer's. I have two copies. Fuck me, right? which is where we get the term ApoE4 homozygous, meaning you're ApoE4, and homozygous means you have two copies of that allele. Now, quick recap on this. Again, ApoE is an important gene in terms of the development of Alzheimer's and cardiovascular disease. Everyone gets two of them, one from mom, one from dad. You can get a 2, a 3, or a 4, and you get one of those from mom and one of those from dad. There are six combinations. Probably the most protective is if you have two copies of two. The kind of default baseline that most people are is having two copies of the three. And the worst outcome is having two copies of the four. And again, if you have a combination of two and four, you're a little bit protected, you know, and a little bit at higher risk. If you have a three and a four, you're one of those, you know, signifies kind of a default baseline, no increase in risk. The other one, the four, signifies an increase in risk, and so on. You can just think of it as two is protective, three is baseline, and four is not great. Now, I want to just make a pit stop here. A note on this sounding kind of grim, right? This sounding kind of depressing, right? Like here I am, only 2 to 3% carry two copies. If you have two copies, you're up to 12 times more likely to develop Alzheimer's. It can be depressing. And I'm going to talk about this idea of, should you get tested if this, you know, if you're going to find out something bad and it's going to stress you out, right? Like, am I happy that I am ApoE4 homozygous? No, I'm not happy about it. Is it empowering me to make changes? Absolutely. And I'm going to explore this idea a little bit more in a bit. Couple other statistics on ApoE4 and the risk for Alzheimer's dementia. ApoE4 is the strongest known genetic risk factor. Again, having one copy increases risk by 2 to 3, two copies by 8 to 12. About 40 to 65% of people with Alzheimer's have at least one ApoE4. ApoE4 is associated with an earlier onset of symptoms. And an aggregate of the studies show that if you are E4E4, you have a 60% chance of developing Alzheimer's dementia by age 85. That one, to me, really hits home. That is a frightening statistic. And, you know, I think 85 is not a spring chicken, let's say, but not where I hope my cognition starts to fall off, let's say. I hope to have my cognition, you know, be as, you know, cognitively strong and able for longer than that is my goal. And so that one kind of hit me. I was like, okay, let's look into this a bit, right? But hey, it gets better. No, I'm just kidding. It doesn't. ApoE4 is also associated with higher LDL and ApoB. And we'll talk a little bit more about this. It may increase risk of atherosclerosis, which is like, again, plaque buildup in your arteries, associated with earlier onset of cardiovascular disease. And these two kind of work together, this idea of increased risk of cardiovascular disease and increased risk of neurodegenerative disease. Because if you have atherosclerosis in the arteries that bring blood to the brain, right? If you have impaired blood flow to the brain, we see an increased risk in certain vascular dementias and other neurodegenerative diseases, right? I mean, it's not, let's just common sense this here. We have bad, you know, suboptimal blood flow to the brain. It's going to cause some issues in the brain. Now, it's not a death sentence. I want to just say that. It's not a death sentence. Having ApoE4 does not guarantee developing Alzheimer's or heart disease. Many ApoE4 carriers never develop these conditions. There are a lot of modifiable risk factors. There was a recent Lancet update from 2024 that we're going to go through that show 14 modifiable risk factors that claim to be able to reduce the cases of Alzheimer's dementia by about 45%. So about half. Essentially, half of the cases of Alzheimer's dementia can almost, you could say, be eradicated by the combination of these 14 things. Some people out there would say, getting this test done, right? Getting your genetic test done and finding out, you know, what your ApoE genotype is not worth the extra stress, right? And I will say, as someone with the worst outcome possible, I could not disagree more. I'm a nutrition professional. I've been in this profession for 13 years. And I take my health, for those 13 years, I've taken my health very seriously. What I would say is I'm an outlier. Nutrition and health, it's my life. So I am probably not representative of the average person. I probably think about my health a bit more than the average person. I think it's totally fair to say this is my job. That doesn't mean that I'm doing everything to the extreme, but it's a thing I consider more often than the average person. Right? Which means, again, I'm even more likely to care about this stuff. And even I had and have some gaps to fill in terms of risk, things I can improve, right? Knowing that I'm an ApoE4 homozygous, knowing I have this increased risk has been empowering, right? Because there are a lot of modifiable risk factors, a lot, right? If I had no power, then maybe ignorance would be bliss, right? It's like, hey, it's like if I have no power over the outcome, maybe I don't want to know. But I do have power. We do have power. You do have power, right? Somebody might say, and there are some professionals out there in the space who are working in the Alzheimer's space. You know, I think most people in this space would side with the perspective I'm sharing today. But there are some people, which is why I'm having, you know, devoting a few minutes to this, is that we should be doing all this stuff to prevent Alzheimer's anyway. If you're ApoE2 or 3 or 4, it doesn't matter. You should be doing all of that. And when I say all of that, I mean the things we're going to talk about in a second, the 14 modifiable risk factors for Alzheimer's dementia. You know, somebody might say, well, you should be doing that all anyway, because even if you aren't E4, you still have a risk of developing neurodegenerative disease. And so you should still be doing all of those things anyway. Here's the deal. We aren't doing those things. Most people aren't doing the 14 things I'm about to go through. Or at least they're not doing all of them, or they're not motivated by the kind of threat of neurodegenerative disease to do all of these 14 things. So, you know, you can say ignorance is bliss, but I would say knowledge is power. And because there are these 14 things represent, you know, potentially being able to reduce dementia cases by up to 50%, we have so much power. Like, there's so much ability to modify our individual risk. Again, I understand somebody saying, well, you should do those things no matter what. And by the way, if you are listening to this podcast and you don't want to test your genetics, I still think you should do all 14 of these things. I still think that you should have this stuff on your mind. Everybody is, rightly so, by the way, focused on building muscle and strength and bone density, you know, improving their cardiovascular fitness. And I love that. And their idea is, I want to remain physically able. I love that. But I think we forget about, you know, I want to be physically able, but I also want to be cognitively able. I want to have my brain. I want to be me in my head. You know, I want to be me, think like me, for as long as possible. Maybe even more, you know, if you had to take my body or my mind, take my body, right? You know, like, you know, or I know that that's a grim, you know, choice, but I'm just saying it's just as important to me to be physically able as it is cognitively able. And so whether or not you want to get your genetics tested, I think this stuff is important. But if you did want to find out, you can use companies like Empowered Lab, Empowered X Lab, or a company like Function Health. I don't like recommending Function Health as Mark Hyman is one of the owners, I think. But they do very comprehensive risk assessment. They do very comprehensive blood work, and they test for ApoE gene, which is great. I think very important. So you can look at those two companies as a way to get your genes tested here. Now, The Lancet updated their 2020 list of modifiable risk factors. They did this update in 2024. I'll read you kind of the first line of that. The 2024 update to the Standing Lancet Commission on Dementia Prevention, Intervention, and Care adds two new risk factors, high LDL and vision loss, which we'll talk about, and indicates that nearly half of all dementia cases worldwide could be prevented or delayed by addressing 14 modifiable risk factors. Now, in the show notes, I'm going to put up a link to, it's like a little PDF. It's just a single page. It's a really nice graphic, and it shows you these 14 things broken up over early life, midlife, and late life. And it actually puts kind of a percentage point next to it. And so, hey, they have like a modifiable risk factor, which is high LDL cholesterol, let's say, and they put 7%, meaning that, you know, it has that much of an impact on the overall risk profile. And they go through each of the 14, they give you kind of the risk factor associated or the risk increase with that risk factor. I think it's really neat, and it's just a single page. And if you're looking for kind of, if you're more of a visual learner, you might really like enjoying, or you might really enjoy pulling this up and just kind of watching it as we go through this, or, you know, at a later date. So I'm going to go through the 14 things. I'm going to go through which have the highest percent impact, right? Which are the things that mean the most. And then I'll talk about what I'm personally doing. So the 14 modifiable risk factors. Number one, quality of education in early life. Number two, social isolation, particularly later in life. Air pollution, traumatic brain injury, hearing loss, depression, high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity, physical activity, smoking, excessive alcohol consumption, uncorrected vision loss, high cholesterol. Now, when I say high cholesterol, I mean specifically your ApoB. If you're unfamiliar with what ApoB, it is a blood test that doesn't usually come standard on a, let's say you go to your GPP, and you, your PCP, GPP, you go to your PCP and you get just like a standard checkup. They're probably not running ApoB. I think it costs anywhere from $5 to $20. Next time you go get your blood workup from your PCP, I would ask them to test ApoB. It is essentially a marker of all atherogenic particles in your body. LDL particles are, or contain ApoB, and LDL is an okay proxy for your ApoB. I'd say your non-HDL cholesterol is better and does come standard. So if you don't feel like asking your doctor or paying a little extra to get your ApoB checked, you can use non-HDL. That's probably your best bet. But I do think, yeah, I do think you should get your ApoB checked. I think for the $5 to $20, it's absolutely worth it. ApoB is the best single marker we have for risk of cardiovascular disease. And as we're learning here, ApoB is also a large risk factor for the development of Alzheimer's dementia. Again, the last two, vision loss and high cholesterol, or uncorrected vision loss, which I can only assume what they mean is spending long periods of your life without proper vision, are newly added from the previous review in 2020. Now, the top four, the four of those risk factors I just listed out that have been given the highest percent impact, right? Like, attributed to it. The four highest are quality of education in early life, high ApoB, hearing loss, and social isolation later in life. So I want to read that whole list again, and then we're going to talk about what I'm personally doing. So we have quality of education in early life, social isolation, air pollution, traumatic brain injury, hearing loss, depression, high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity, physical activity, smoking, excessive alcohol consumption, uncorrected vision loss, and high cholesterol. And as I'm reading those out, I can't help but think most of those things fall into the category, at least half of those things, of things you should do to be a generally healthy person that you already knew you should do, right? Don't smoke, be physically active, don't have too much body fat, you know, don't have diabetes, make sure your blood pressure's in check. Make sure you don't have super high cholesterol. Don't drink too much. And so there is such an overlap of habits and lifestyle factors, modifiable risk factors that are going to have knock-on effects for many different types of chronic diseases. So if you are focusing on avoiding chronic disease across the board, those are going to be just very overlapping risk factors here or lifestyle factors. Now, what am I personally doing, given my own life, my own lifestyle, my own genetics, all of that? Number one is addressing vision and hearing loss. Hearing and vision loss have to do with basically the brain working to process what you hear and what you see. So the less you see and hear, the less well you can see, the less like auditory signaling you take in, the less work your brain is doing. And so if that's happening for a long period of time, there's a bit of, you know, if you don't use it, you lose it. You know, let's imagine the brain as a muscle here, right? It's like, hey, if you're not using it, you're not training it to remain strong. And so that's kind of where this vision and hearing loss comes in as a risk factor. Now, vision, for me, I've had an astigmatism in my left eye, which has really messed me up for the last maybe 5 years. You guys probably can't tell if you're listening to this, even if you watch my videos. When my wife, I'll tell you this, when my wife watches my videos, she can tell that my left eye is not great. You know, it's not quite what they're talking about in these terms of risk factors. They're talking a little bit more about cataracts and like diabetic retinopathy, but still, my left eye is not great and it's not getting better. I have trouble maintaining eye contact with people for long periods. I have trouble just honestly looking straight on for long time periods. I've seen many doctors in the last 5 years. I've seen four different eye doctors, ophthalmologists, optometrists and ophthalmologists. Those are the two. Yep. And not poo-pooing on that profession, but what I'm going to say is that it hasn't been helpful. The best that they've been able to suggest, I wear glasses, but it doesn't really help. It helps a tiny bit, but it's certainly something I still struggle with every single day. And the best that they were able to suggest in terms of long-term benefits was essentially like eye physical therapy, like physical therapy for my eyes. And it's really expensive and takes a lot of time. If they were like 100% sure that that would clear me up and it would get way better and it would get, they just weren't. I didn't get any of that. They're like, it might help. I'm like, yeah, for like multiple hours a week and insurance not really covering it, the best you can say is it might help. And so I have not felt the motivation to go that route. Anyway, if you're an ophthalmologist or an optometrist and you believe you have the key to helping me, you're very welcome to reach out. But in the meantime, this has invigorated me to not give up, because I will tell you, I'd given up. I'd seen multiple doctors and I had just gotten to a point where I just gave up and I was like, cool, I'm just going to deal with it. And it frustrates me on a daily basis, but it's not frustrating enough for me to spend many, many hours a week and a lot of money trying to do something that might not work. But anyway, this has invigorated me to make sure I don't give up on that. I don't think I should go the next 60 years without figuring this out. Next for me is hearing loss. I will tell you, I spent, you know, from the time I turned 18 till probably I was about 30, basically hugging concert speakers. And I will tell you, no matter what I do, I'm screwed. This is one, if I could go back in time, this is one that actually gives me a little bit of angst. You know, if I could go back in time, I would have been that kid at the concerts with earplugs in, because I've done irreparable damage to my ears. Now, I don't feel it now, but I know that there will be a time where my hearing starts to go, and the onset of that will be accelerated because of those, let's call it 12 years of nonstop hugging speakers at concerts, loud EDM concerts. You know, from like 18 to 23, my friends and I had like a music blog and we would travel to these concerts and interview DJs or whatever, and tons of concerts, tons of just getting blasted with bass. And if I could go back in time, I would absolutely, if I knew what I knew about this as a risk factor for Alzheimer's, if I was sitting here with the knowledge I have today, I would have adjusted what I was doing. Now, what am I doing as of today? What I'm doing is making sure I don't listen to mega, mega loud music in my headphones for long periods, right? I'm just making a commitment to reduce the volume of my music when I'm using headphones. There are apps like HearSafe that monitor how loud you're listening to music. And essentially what they do is they lower it very slowly to a lower decibel that is less likely to cause damage, and they do it very gradually, right? And so what they say is that you won't notice that they're lowering it, that you will almost, your brain and your ears will almost like accommodate or regulate to the sound. And over time, they gradually decrease the sound. And I will tell you, I've used that app before. They are right. I don't notice that they're doing it, right? I'm like, I might start my run out and listen to music, and they will gradually, if I'm listening too loud, they will gradually make it a little softer, and I genuinely don't notice. The next thing I'm doing is addressing my ApoB. Now, 2 years ago, I got very comprehensive blood work done from one of these companies, and I was pleased to find out that my ApoB was 49. I think the reference range where you want to be is below 90. I think below 50 is regarded as very good. And truthfully, that's pretty good at 49, and I'm proud of that. That said, I think in general, but also in the case of me being, you know, an ApoE4 homozygous, I think this is a context where lower is better and lower is worth working towards. So maybe for the past 12 months or so, I've been working to get it even lower. I have not done more blood work. My plan is to do that before the summer. And I'm aiming for below 40. Honestly, I'm aiming for as low as possible, but basically what I'm aiming for is, which we'll go over in a second, is the things you can do to lower your ApoB. My plan is to just do all of those things as much as I realistically can and see how low I can drive my ApoB. There's, of course, you know, lengths that I will not go to, right? That just at some point, you know, the difference between the kind of life I'd have to leave to have, life I'd have to live to have an ApoB of 28 or 31, you know, is different enough that I don't feel like doing those things. So we all have a limit. But for the past year, I've been trying to lower it with some of the things I'm going to go over in a second, and I'm curious where it is. I will say that blood work can be tricky, and it can be really disappointing if you get a one-off blood work test and it doesn't come out the way you want. And so I want to say that, I think I've been putting it off mostly because I don't want to be disappointed if I haven't been able to lower it, because 49 is already low. It's like trying to go from being lean to being even leaner, or, you know, so even if my ApoB was 49, I'm still pretty darn happy with that. So really quick, quick pause on the podcast to talk about the carnivore diet really quick. The carnivore diet is rife with people bragging about their high cholesterol, making, you know, stupid claims like, oh, the brain is made of cholesterol, and so we need more cholesterol in the blood. And people who are proud of their crazy high LDL, crazy high ApoB, that their doctor is super scared of, but my doctor doesn't know anything. He's indoctrinated or whatever. Having high ApoB is dangerous. And I did a podcast with a guy named Nick Norwitz about what are called lean mass hyper-responders, which are lean, otherwise healthy people who are eating a low-carb diet, who have really, really high LDL and ApoB. And the hypothesis is that those people, because they are otherwise healthy, are at a lower risk than others. And that might be somewhat true, but I did a follow-up episode with Alan Flanagan, who you should absolutely be following. Not entirely 100% debunking that idea in general, but certainly debunking the top end that this could be benign, that those people could be at no increased risk, and confirming that they are most likely at a high enough risk that they should not be doing that. And so if you're interested in low-carb dieting, the carnivore world where people are proud of their high cholesterol, where they think it doesn't matter, you can listen to those episodes. I will also link them in the show notes. The first one with Nick Norwitz, the second one with Alan Flanagan. And frankly, if I'm going to be blunt here, I would only listen to the Alan Flanagan one, because I think you can spend, I was on the podcast with Nick for like 2 hours, and I'm not saying I was hoodwinked on that episode. That's not how I feel, but I think Alan does a good job. The podcast with Alan does a good job painting both sides of that equation. Now, back to our discussion here. How should you go about trying to lower your ApoB or your non-HDL cholesterol, let's say? I've titled this section how I'm lowering it, but this should just be a more general discussion on how to lower it. Here are the things that you can do. Eat less saturated fat from animal protein, red meat, other animal proteins, specifically red meat, and butter. Not all saturated fat or types of saturated fat are created equal and have the same impact on your lipids. And that's why I make a distinction to say from red meat and butter, because there are other types of saturated fat, like saturated fat found in dark chocolate, which seems to be a net positive, in fact. And so essentially what I'm doing is I don't eat butter. And so I'm reducing my red meat intake. And I will say that I've enjoyed, because my ApoB was 49 and I was not at that time caring so much, I was eating red meat a couple times a week probably, I was pretty proud that my ApoB was 49, even though I was eating quite a bit of red meat. You can see that when we talk about this in a sec, I'm doing some of this other stuff really well as well. But one of the meaningful things I did is I had a ButcherBox subscription for a long time, and I recently in the last several months canceled it. And I've just been, you might see more red meat on my social media, and that's because I'm working through a freezer full of red meat, trying to free up some freezer space. But overall, going to leaner cuts of red meat and eating less red meat, the rule that Jenna and I have decided is we'll eat red meat max once per week, if at all. So max once per week, if at all. Keeping calories from saturated fat to below 8% total calories. And frankly, even lower than that. There are some people who would say that bringing your saturated fat maybe below 5% is a good place to be. For now, I eat a lot of dark chocolate. And so if I look at just my saturated fat intake overall, it's a little bit skewed. But if I can keep it below 8%, not eat a lot of red meat, eat no butter, I feel pretty good about that. Next is increase the intake of plant protein. So frankly, we have research where people, these two are kind of intimately intertwined here, eating less red meat and more plant protein. That sort of a swapping out of some red meat for plant protein has shown all kinds of health benefits and, of course, an improvement in lipid profile. So for me, that means more beans, more lentils, more bean pasta, which I really have enjoyed. I'm a big pasta guy, and companies like Kaizen or even Bonza is okay, and there are some other bean pasta companies have made it really easy to increase my intake of plant protein. And I will say I'm still working on tofu. I've mentioned on the podcast a few times that I'd like to have tofu once a week. I made tofu a couple weeks ago, and it was terrible. And I will admit that's because I'm terrible at making it. And so I reached out to some friends who are tofu connoisseurs who gave me some better recipes and cooking methods, and I have a suspicion that it will be much better. I was winging it, and I should not have done that. Next is an increase in fiber. Essentially, as much fiber as I can handle or you can handle without GI discomfort. Typically, we give a recommendation of about 10 to 15 grams of fiber per 1,000 calories. You know, something like 20 to 25 for women and 30 to 35 for men as a kind of extrapolation of that ratio. But we've seen in epidemiological studies that higher fiber is better, period, unless you have GI discomfort, for sure. So I think the way I would really think about fiber is at least 10 to 15 grams per 1,000 calories, and then more is better, provided you don't get GI discomfort, and you're less likely to get GI discomfort if you gradually increase your fiber. So some people are like eating 25 grams and they go all the way up to 50 and they're like, oh my God, I get GI discomfort. So 50 is too much. It's like, well, 50 might've been too much for you then. But if you went from 25 to 30, 30 to 35, 35 to 40, you might've been able to get yourself up higher than you think. The next is an increase in unsaturated fats. So poly or monounsaturated fats, nuts, fish, avocado, seeds, all really great, you know, avocados, all really great sources of unsaturated fats. Now, increasing fiber, increasing plant protein, and increasing unsaturated fat, particularly polyunsaturated fat, actively bring LDL down, right? They actively bring LDL down. That's what they do. The other ones here, I'd say, are just normal, basic things you already know you should be doing, right? The things that you know you should be doing to be in what we would call good metabolic health. Right? Exercise regularly, don't have too much body fat, manage stress, get enough sleep, don't smoke, don't drink too much. You know, for me, when it comes to exercise, I was lifting when I got that blood work done. And I had not done any cardio. And for me, I'm not saying introducing cardio is going to bring my ApoB down very much. It's already pretty low. I was already pretty fit. But for me, I couldn't look myself in the face and say I was doing absolutely everything on this list. I was not. I wasn't eating enough fiber. I wasn't eating any plant protein. I was eating too much red meat. I was doing no cardio. Now, what I can say is, since making some of these changes, my circulatory system, my blood flow is the best it's ever been. And we'll just leave it at that. A quick note on medication. Can we stop being so afraid of the use of pharmacology? It can be super helpful. Just a quick note. My dad had an ApoB of about 130. And he's lean. He eats a pretty good diet. Doesn't eat any red meat. Doesn't eat butter. You know, I wish he could lift a few more weights. That'd be great. But he does a lot of walking. He walks a lot of hills. He does a lot of hiking. And we couldn't get his ApoB any lower. We had a 125, we had a 135, we had a 128. And since starting a low-dose rosuvastatin, his ApoB is 70. Now, I will say going from 130 to 70 is a bigger drop than you'd expect taking the lowest dose rosuvastatin. But it's also technically true that during that time period, he upped his game in terms of some of these other things, increased his intake of beans and lentils and bean pasta and stuff, increased his fiber intake on purpose, just like intentionally more fruits, more vegetables, a shift to more fibrous fruits and vegetables. And so combining lifestyle plus, you know, this low dose pharmacology was incredible. I just want to be very clear. I might cry, but going from 130 to 70 is really unbelievable. Unbelievable stuff, man. I don't want to say like life altering stuff. I don't want to go too hyperbolic with it, but man, going from 130 to 70, we were over the moon. And so I just want to make a note here of, you know, pharmacology can be super helpful and we shouldn't shy away from it as a tool alongside lifestyle. The next two that I'm implementing, or at least that are on my mind a lot, the next one is social isolation. I will tell you, I love social isolation. I love social isolation. I am a homebody. When I say I'm independent, what I mean is I'm an introvert. I don't have a large appetite to be around people 24/7. But this idea of community and togetherness and social interaction permeates through, you know, all longevity cultures. You know, I don't want to do that. I don't want to go the blue zones, you know, but like one of the actual threads of the blue zones are a large sense of community and togetherness. And I think that specifically the Lancet says social isolation in older age, but I think this is just always social interaction is good for the soul. I think we all have our own ideal dose, preferred dose. But I do think I can resort to being too isolated if left to my own devices. And I do think that when I do branch out and have more social life, that I do feel good. Now, I will say I still don't need and or want as much as some other people, which, by the way, it's no judgment. People do what they want. It's great. But I do think that my happiest life is probably like one standard deviation above my default. And one of the things we're trying to do is actually, we live in North Carolina. Our family live in New Jersey. We're trying to move home for me, for my daughter, for my parents. All of us, you know, will benefit from that community, you know, that family, that social connection. And again, if this is social isolation as you get older, then I think about my dad too, you know, and my dad has a lot of friends. He's way more social than I am. That, you know, he's always at a dinner party or something. And I'm so happy he does that. It really does matter a lot, but also being near his granddaughter, his kids, you know, Jenna and me, I know that that will mean a lot. And the last one that's on my mind a lot in my life is quality education early in life for my daughter. She obviously has my genes, and so I bet she has an ApoE4 at least one, you know. And so I think about that, and I think, okay, what does that mean now? What are you going to do? I want to be tentative as I go through this next part, because I think parenting can go from positive to obsessive and competitive really quick. And I want to stay on the positive side. So when I think about, like, it can go from trying to do a nice thing to overbearing, obsessive, competitive, and net negative really quick. And that, I've seen that just from being a parent for 1 year. But what I think about is, hey, this doesn't mean that you every single day wake up and you're running through flashcards with your one-year-old daughter. But what it means is that, you know, and it's about increasing the importance of stuff I already knew I should be doing, which is, it's just nurturing. It's just nurturing a curious mind. I just want to be a present parent with her and nurture her cognitive development. And I don't mean, again, I'm not saying every day we're doing a friggin' cognitive puzzle because we want her to boost her IQ. I'm just saying I want to be present. I want to do things with her. I want to expose her to things, not in a way that I'm putting a ton of pressure on myself, but in a way, like, pressure is such an interesting thing. Pressure is an upside down U-shaped curve. It's a normal distribution. What I mean is that having no pressure to do anything is probably not how you become your best self or have your best life. Having too much pressure can be a negative, right? It's just like too much pressure can create, you know, paralysis analysis or just, you know, paralysis because of anxiety. What I want to do is find that sweet spot where I'm feeling pressured to do good things for myself and my daughter, my family, et cetera, but not so much pressure that it's crippling, right? And so I want to be a present parent throughout her education and just do our best as parents to nurture a curious mind. That word curious is something that I hold near and dear as a human trait and want to help my daughter have as she grows up. Yeah. So let's go through all of them one more time. We'll do a recap and we'll get you guys out of here. We're already at the 40-minute mark here. So the 14 risk factors: quality of education in early life, social isolation later in life, air pollution, traumatic brain injury, hearing loss, depression, high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity, physical inactivity, smoking, excessive alcohol consumption, uncorrected vision loss, and high cholesterol. Now, quick recap. I did some genetic testing back in 2022 and found that I have two copies of what's called the APOE4 gene or APOE4 allele. APOE4 is the strongest known genetic risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. It also increases the risk of cardiovascular disease by 2 to 3 times. I don't know if I said that. We get two copies of the APOE gene, one from each parent. The combination of them determines their risk profile. If you have two copies of APOE2, that's probably the most protective. If you have two copies of APOE3, that's the baseline, the default. And if you have two copies of APOE4, that is the worst. It's not a death sentence, but it definitely increases risk of Alzheimer's and cardiovascular disease. While some would say that ignorance is bliss, I respectfully disagree. Knowledge is power. I think I would want to know. Period. I would want to know. And so you can, I don't know if any PCPs would have, or any insurance covers any of this stuff, but you can use those companies I listed in the show. I'll put them in the show notes as well. I would want to know. The Lancet 2024 update had 14 modifiable risk factors. We went through 1,000 times here. And the things I'm personally changing or focusing on right now for me is lowering my ApoB as much as is realistically practical. Addressing hearing and vision loss, or let's say, my hearing and vision issues. Addressing social isolation, making sure I don't fall into a normal pattern for me of a bit of isolation as I think I can. Fostering, my daughter's early years or fostering a good a curious mind, being a present parent throughout my child's early education, whatever that means. My daughter's only one. I don't know at all. I have no idea what that is. She has no education yet. We are just playing. And I know playing is education right now for her, but I don't pretend to know it all. I don't want that to be how this comes off. I just want to be a present parent throughout her education. That's all. But all of the above are important. I think that those are some really important ones for me. But if you listen to that list and you're like, well, I have high blood pressure, I'm pre-diabetic, and, you know, maybe my vision isn't great. Maybe those are some things that jump off the page for you. Again, I'll link a bunch of things in the show notes. Some of those episodes, the one from Simon Hill, some of the links to where you can get your genetic test done, the Lancet infographic, which I think is really puts us into perspective really nicely, will all be in the show notes. And if you have a question, don't hesitate to reach out. This is a topic near and dear to my heart, something that I, you know, there are a lot of things I work on with my clients. This is one that is just incredibly top of mind for me and holds a special place in my heart. So if you want to talk about it, you can always reach out, and I'm happy to do so. All right. See you in the next one.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.